When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Friday, November 20th, 2020. On today's episode, we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion about the fourth episode of Disney Plus's The Mandalorian Season 2, entitled The Siege. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And special guest from Star Wars Insider, StarWars.com, the Fullest Sith podcast, and a little site called SlashFilm.com, Brian Young.
It is my great pleasure to join you all.
Okay, before we get into this episode, let's talk about some feedback we got from last week's episode. I always get, you know, we get emails, we get comments and stuff that we just bring up. This one had a lot less feedback than usual, but you know, we were all praising Bryce Dallas Howard last week with last week's episode, her direction, not to take anything away from her and how good that episode was. But we did get a message from someone who wants to remain nameless saying that pointing out that Sam Hargrave was the second unit director of that last episode. He did stunts and second unit on films like Endgame, Deadpool 2, Atomic Blonde, and The Accountant. And not that we should take any credit away from Bryce Dallas Howard, but also we should know that that talent was involved.
Could I ask if Sam Hargrave is the one who sent you this message?
he was not, but...
Okay. No, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. Can I maybe push back a little bit on this?
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Because like when a movie is bad or good, no one ever goes like, "Well, that director's fine," but really, the second unit director, like it smacks. I'm not saying the listener.
Everything falls on the director. Yes.
Like, I'm not saying that this smacks of sexism, but maybe it does a little bit. Where like if. Like, nobody said that J.J. Abrams' second unit director on Rise of Skywalker really dropped the ball. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
but wasn't his second unit director a female?
Yeah, it was. But the point is that, like, I guess the thing I'm saying is that when no one was praising a woman here in this case, where we're like, oh, she did great. And then somebody kind of nudges and elbows their way in and says, like,
yeah,
hey, you know, like, she's great and all, but there was this guy here behind the scenes who propped all that up for her. Sam Hargraves is great. His stunt work is great. But yeah, that narrative, I don't know. It just smacks me the wrong way a little bit.
No, I definitely see. That's why I was trying to present it in a a way. I don't know. I was trying. Yes, I could totally see that narrative. I don't think that's where... The person who submitted this is someone within the film industry that, like, probably works with a lot of people on a... I don't know. I took it more of a craft thing than a sexism thing, but...
And that stuff was great.
Yeah. So, but yeah, good point. That is a good point. You know, when things are great, you know, when Avengers Endgame, like, when people are talking about how great the action is in that, like, you know... Rarely do they point out Sam Hargrave, right? So
yeah,
it's the Russo brothers. So like you have a good point, Brian. So, but yeah, okay. The other thing I wanted to point out is that Axe Wolves. He was one of the Mandalorian from last week's episode. We learned that was actually a name that was created by George Lucas while visiting set. So
that's the most George Lucas name. This guy looks tough. Let's name him Axe.
It is. Although, like, the most George Lucas name would be like Axe Strongman. Like, you need to like have like a last name that like tells you more about what they do.
Axe or something. Chopping stuff.
Yes.
That's the next toy.
Yeah.
With chopping action.
In our I do a live stream every Saturday talking about Mandalorian, and one of the people in there named Ziem had a little like funny bit of speculation. They said they said, do you think when Ahsoka finally meets up with the Mandalorian and the child, and Mando asks her, you know, do you know where this, you know, child, like, what, you know, anything about this child? Do you think Ahsoka will comment that it looks like a baby Yoda? Because she knows Yoda, right? Would that be a funny way to comment on the fandom, or no? Do you think they won't go there?
But, like, this episode was also written before the fandom knew about Baby Yoda.
That's true. True. Well, you're talking about episode... We're going to assume she's going to appear in episode 5.
But also, I think that everyone was on set, though, was still referring to him as Baby Yoda, right?
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, because they didn't have a species name, or at least most people don't know it if they do know it yet, so...
I just think it would be a fun way to... you know, make a joke that kind of canonizes Baby Yoda in a way. Not that it like changes the child's name to Baby Yoda, but it would just be a funny like inside reference.
And having somebody who doesn't know who Yoda is say like, why do you keep calling it that?
Who's Yoda?
Yeah. The other thing I saw on Twitter, Jordan Mason, he made a tweet, said, what if we eventually get a movie down the road that takes place 300 years after the Rise of Skywalker, featuring a grown version of the child, raising a new generation of Skywalkers, telling the stories of his Mandalorian father and how they helped reunite the clans. Do you think we're ever going to get an adult Baby Yoda?
I think it's pretty doubtful, although it does make me wonder whether Yoda's entire species
makes you wonder what
makes me wonder if Yoda's entire species speaks backwards the same way that Yoda does.
Oh,
or, you know, because you have to wonder if it's going to be weird hearing another species, because we've never heard Yaddle talk, even though we've seen her. But yeah, that's it would be interesting to see what a different, older, you know, version of Yoda's species would be like once it's able to actually talk and isn't like a baby. But yeah.
Did we ever hear Yaddle talk in, like, any of the expanded non-canon, now Legends books or anything like that? Like, did we ever get any dialogue from Yaddle?
I can't think of any off the top of my head. I know she had some stories, but I can't remember if they were told as, like, someone else was relating them. And I can't... I will do some digging into that.
Okay. We'll report back on next episode. Okay, let's get into this episode. This is episode 4 of season 2. This is chapter 12 in this series. It's 39 minutes long with that, you know, recap and the intro and the concept art and all that stuff. So it's really like a 30-minute episode or so. Carl Weathers is the director. He's directed a lot of like television over the years. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, he got his start directing in television, doing a whole bunch of episodes of Silk Stockings, which is an interesting place for him to start. And he's been around film and the camera, you know, since the 70s. So it's not a surprise he took that jump. But at the Mandalorian conference, press conference that we were both at, Peter, you remember him talking on the stage about how him getting offered the part came with the caveat that he wanted to direct too, because that was really the trajectory his career had been in, and he was less interested in acting and more interested in directing. Yeah. And this episode was the result of that.
This is easily the biggest thing that he's done too. Like, looking back at his filmography, like, this is crazy bigger than any other thing that he's worked on. Like, the biggest show.
What is the biggest thing before this, Brad?
He did an episode of the new Hawaii Five-0 for CBS.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen anything directed by Carl Weathers. I will say, after seeing this episode, I am impressed. I mean, there might be something to be said about this machine that is this, the Mandalorian, like, you know, like it seems like they're really in a groove and, you know, it might be, I don't want to say easy to succeed in this venue, but like, I don't know. I thought it was pretty impressive. Like he did a pretty good job. Of course, you know, he made it fun and interesting and exciting, even though it's another adventure of the week. It, you know, in terms of the story, it progresses the main mystery of what Moff Gideon's plan is and the hunt for Baby Yoda, and has some familiar beats kind of echoing the original trilogy in ways. Brad, what did you think of this week's episode?
Well, I think it should be noted that the second unit director was... No, this was a solid episode. It was, you know, we talked last week and I predicted that this would be kind of a detour for Mando, that he needed to get his ship fixed and would probably end up going on some kind of, you know, side mission with Kara and Grief. And that's exactly what we get here. But the great thing about it is that it's not entirely just, you know, another adventure of the week, because we actually learn some cool stuff, which we'll get to later, that ties into the over arc of the child and what the Empire wants with it and that kind of thing. So this had good action. It developed the story in a way that was satisfying. And so it was one of those episodes where, even though it was, you know, a pit stop, I think it was a valuable one.
Brian, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I'm really on board with that. This felt like the trip to the gas station on the way, you know, in the middle of the road trip toward the final destination. The episode really had a lot of that classic Star Wars feel. And I'm sure we'll talk more about this, because there are homages to A New Hope, Empire, and Jedi all through this episode. And I think that's where Carl Weathers sort of cut his teeth on Star Wars in the first place as a fan. So that makes a lot of sense that he would sort of get this episode in that way. But also, like, it just had this really fun... I put in my review for Slash Film that he brought, like, this big grandpa energy to it. Right? Like, and yeah. And it just sort of permeates everything, where it's exactly like... I can imagine, like, watching reruns of MASH with my grandfather, like, it gave me that feeling, right, of, like, that sort of generation and their take on Star Wars in a way that is really interesting, and we haven't got that with any of the other episodes as much, I think.
No, that's definitely fair. Okay, let's jump into this episode and go beat by beat. It begins with the Razor Crest is having trouble and Baby Yoda is helping rewire the ship, but he doesn't quite understand Mando's instructions and short circuits the power. Is it just me, or does this feel like it's very like Baby Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, I mean, Groot, but also I think there's a little bit of an homage to Han and Chewie here too, you know, where Han's easily like, no, that one goes there, this one goes here kind of thing. And it's a cute scene watching him try to figure it out and be kind of confused, and just I simply him just looking back and forth at the wires is just, you know, such a delightful little moment.
Yeah, no, I got more of a Han and Chewie vibe, but also like when he's actually getting electrocuted, it reminded me a lot of that moment with Jar Jar and Phantom Menace, and there's a surprising amount of Phantom Menace in this episode too.
Oh, you're going to have to point out some of that, because I'm not sure I connected the dots there. Okay, so they need to go back to Navarro for a repair. So we're going to pat ourselves on the back here, because we all guessed it. He wasn't going to Corvus this episode. We're not going to see Ahsoka this episode. You know, he got distracted again with another adventure of the week. Mando is drinking some kind of like soup or something without taking off his mask, which seems very difficult to me. I guess he won't even take off his mask in front of the child, although he does open his helmet a little. So I guess my question here is the rule bending beginning to start here?
I mean, I think we talked before about how, well, wondering what he did when he had to eat, you know, when he was like in restaurants and things like that. And so it seems like that at least in private, his workaround is lifting the helmet up, you know, slightly to slurp that soup or bone broth or whatever it was. So it seems like as long as he's not revealing, you know, any identifying marks, that he can lift his helmet up enough that he can like either, you know, sip something, or, you know, put a fork up, a spoon up to his mouth and eat that way.
I kind of love that there's probably, I'm not sure if there's a writer's room on this. Obviously, Favreau is credited as the screenwriter of most of these episodes. But I kind of feel like that one shot was there because someone asked Favreau, like, how does he eat? Right? Like, so I love that they put that in there.
I think it could be, too, just him showing his increasing comfort with the child.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you look at other scenes where he's out in public ordering food for the child, he's never taking any himself. He never even goes for the glass. In season one on Sorgan, when they bring him food, he lets the child go out and play so he can take his mask off to eat. So either it's an acknowledgement that like, well, I'm stuck with this kid and it's my I'm essentially its parent and I have to eat in front of it. Or it is him getting more lax with that, especially after last episode, seeing real Mandalorians doing, doing things with their masks off. Maybe that's having an influence on him.
Yeah. Okay. So we're back on Navarro. We see a bunch of aliens raiding the former Mandalorian lair. And Brian, these aliens look a little familiar.
Yeah, so these are Aqualish. These are the same species that Ponda Baba was. Ponda Baba was the denizen of the Star Wars cantina in Mos Eisley in A New Hope. And he was one of the two people that harassed Luke, and he's the one who got his arm cut off. One of my favorite bits of trivia is that because of all the reshoots from Star Wars, there's shots of Ponda Baba with like flipper hands, but the close up, that iconic close up of the arm getting cut off, or the cut off arm, he has very pronounced hairy fingers. And so it spawned a whole lot of explanations as of to why, walrus men, as they were referred to for a long time, because that was how they sold his toy.
Yeah, that was the action figure name, right? Like it was Walrus Man and there's Hammerhead and all those. Like, yeah, I love that.
And so why he had flippers in some shots, but the insert shot had the hands, and all of these Aqualish have the big hairy hands. And that's funny to me for whatever reason.
So they're canonizing the hands, I guess, instead of.
Well,
the flipper?
They've been canonized both ways, right? And so. I mean, because there are very clearly shots of Ponda Baba with the flippers, and, the shot of his arm off on the floor has the hands. So maybe they were mittens. Who knows?
It's also interesting to note the variation in the appearance of their faces, because I feel like Ponda Baba's face has always looked like he has two shaved testicles hanging off of his face. but if there's at least one in this gang here where like it almost looks like they appear to be like bigger buck teeth, even though they clearly aren't teeth, but like their shape is it's a little more elongated and flat as opposed to being, round and puffy.
Yeah, no, definitely. And we saw a little bit of that evolution in the prequels when they were appearing as senators in Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones.
Okay. So they almost kill this creature. It's like a ferret like creature. Is that anything we know, Brian?
Not that I could tell. It did remind me sort of thematically of the, and I wonder if it'll end up in this way too, but just the monkey in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where it just started showing up. And when it showed back up at the end of the episode, I'm like, oh, that thing's a spy.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
That could just be me being a silly though.
It does have red eyes.
Yeah, no, that's always a big tip off.
Well, Cara Dune arrives and takes them all out because she's a badass, and that's her only real defining character in my mind. I guess the armor has moved on to another planet or something. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think that was a really careful bit of filmmaking, actually, as far as like we'd been talking about over the season, them telling stories with the design and the shots and seeing all of the Mandalorian stuff sort of only ghosts of it there. I felt really implied that they had moved on and that the armorer wasn't going to just leave all that stuff there, but it could also very easily be taken as the armorer was killed in that final fight where we saw them, and whoever was left, sold off all the Beskar they could.
But you'd think they would find her body in this, like they would show her body or something.
Well, right? It seems like it had been ransacked before they showed up. It looked like they were already, you know, they were, this was their first moments setting up camp.
Okay, well, Cara Dune saves this ferret-like creature, gives him some food, so we're now supposed to care about her, right? I don't know. I think, like, there's a lot of, like, ill will towards the actress that plays Cara Dune. Like, she's, there's some been some controversy online recently, like, in the last year, right? And...
yeah, she's been tweeting some transphobic stuff, and she's been
also
tweeting
anti-mask. Yeah, and she's been like
conspiracies, yeah,
liking tweets from like crazy right wing pundits on Twitter, and
yeah, I want to say I didn't. Parler. Oh yeah, in Parler. I want to say I didn't like her even in the first season before I knew any of that stuff, but. I do find it interesting. I go to a lot of Targets and stuff like that, and I always look in the figure aisle, and I'm always curious to see, like, what figures are warming the peg, you know, the peg warmers. And I think, like, the recent thing that I see at every single store I go to is Cara Dune. No one wants the Cara Dune figures, and there's usually, like, six of them there.
Is it the regular Cara Dune figure, or is it the new Credit Collection Cara Dune figure?
Credit Collection one.
So, yeah, so I think that makes sense, because that's new, and so those just hit shelves, so that might be why you're encountering them more, but the fact that that's left behind more often than the rest of the Credit Collection is still probably indicative, because I have never seen the regular Cara Dune figure in stores anywhere. And because, I don't know if it's because it was in such short supply, or it was initially popular from the first season. But yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so we get the chapter title, The Siege. I don't think we need to really ask what this means. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. Or, Brian, do you have any, like, does it have any double meanings or anything?
Well, I think the siege is very much a loaded term in so far as the Mandalorian and the Siege of Mandalore, but I didn't really draw any significant connections to the Siege of Mandalore. It really just seems like it's on the surface with, yeah, there's a Mandalorian siege and some stuff.
So Cara and Greef Karga meet Mando and the child after they land on the planet. We learn that Cara is now a marshal, and Karga offers to fix his ship. Let's hope that he does better than the Mon Calamari from the previous episode. Navarro looks more like a bustling place. It looks like a good place to be, where, like, we saw, like, last season, like, the town square and stuff, and it looked very different. The cantina has been turned into a... is it the cantina? I think it's the cantina, right? That's been turned into a school.
It didn't seem to me as the cantina. The cantina felt like a different building, and that different building I thought we'd seen sort of with still partially rubble, because it had been decimated in the last episode of the last season.
Maybe I'm wrong there, but they're basically have created a school, and there's a protocol droid in there teaching a classroom of kids about the Hydean Way. What is the Hydean Way?
So the Hydean Way is one of the major hyperspace routes in the Star Wars galaxy. It's been around, sort of like floating around in the canon for a long time. There were the first mention of it in the new canon came in the Clone Wars, and it's been referenced quite a bit in all of the books and the movies, or the TV shows. And so it's not a surprise to get it when it's a giant galactic history lesson. But the Hydean Way is a huge major hyperspace route that connects one side of the galaxy with the other in really safe lanes of travel. There's a lot of other Easter eggs in the protocol droids dialogue too that were a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's like teaching basic, I guess, geography and politics of the galaxy here. Do you think it's more like this is just fun Easter eggs, or do you think some of this information is being set up to the audience for later?
I don't think it's being set up for the audience, because her voice, like some of the information that would be the most interesting and useful for the audience for later, her voice is really behind the scene, as it were. And you almost don't even notice it unless you're watching the subtitles, like her explaining the transfer of power in the galaxy from the Old Republic's capital of Coruscant to Chandrila is something that's important, but you can barely hear it.
Yeah, it almost seems to me like something that was written in the script, like that was going to be more audible. And then like when they directed and edited it, it became like, oh, this is more of a scene about Mando leaving the child in this classroom and, you know, Baby Yoda trying to convince the kid next to him to give him some of his food.
So listening to Matt Wood talk about how he works sometimes and listening to how the voice actors, like the additional voice talent work, I would 100% not be surprised if Carl Weathers' direction for the protocol droid was just to look like a teacher and they'd worry about the dialogue later. And then Matt Wood, as they were doing all of their nerdy ADR, decided what that history lesson would be.
Fair enough. So Baby Yoda uses the Force to steal the food from the child next to him. And it looks like the child's just eating macaroons. Macarons?
Yeah, they look like...
I don't even know. They look
like blue macarons.
Yeah, like, I didn't know that macarons were in the Star Wars galaxy.
They've got space waffles. Why not space macarons?
Maybe they're setting this up for a macaron cart in Galaxy's Edge one of these days.
I'm in.
Okay, Mando, and by the way, this is another time I know it's kind of becoming comical at this point where we have like this thing that is like one of the most wanted things in the galaxy, and Mando just like, because, you know, because the plot makes it hard for him to carry Yoda or the child everywhere, like he just like leaves them with like strangers, like wherever he goes to go off in his, you know, whatever he needs to go do. But whatever, we don't need to second guess that in any way. Okay, so the Mando is reunited with the blue alien that he captured and encased in carbonite from Chapter One. This is the guy that was played by Horatio Sands.
Yeah,
and he has a physical reaction of fear, which is kind of cool.
Also, so I'm curious about this. Maybe Brian can shed some light on it, but they keep calling him Mithril, and I think isn't that the name of his race? Or species, rather?
That's what we've been led to believe, but he's also the first of the species that we've been introduced to. So, and since there aren't any, like, really official source books on Star Wars, or on the Mandalorian so far, it could really easily be both, or they could all just be horribly racist and just keep referring to him by his species.
Yeah, because there's I looked this up because there's a line that that a Mithril, I don't know it has to be this character, but says, if you've never seen a fledgling Mithril evacuate their thorax, you're a lucky guy, trust me, which would seem to imply that it is species.
Yeah. But and who, like, so knowing the story, the guys in the story group, like, I could very easily see Pablo or Matt or even Leland like spackling this by like, oh, they're calling him that because that's what they're like, their entire species is collectivist and that's what they call themselves and each other. And maybe he has some other name that nobody refers to. But I mean, it's the same thing as Greef Karga calling Din Djarin Mando the whole time, too. So maybe it's something like that.
I mean, theoretically, you could argue that he could be talking about himself in third person. Like, it'd be like, Brad, you never want to see a Peter Serretta go to the bathroom. Right?
That's fair.
That's, yeah. You're right. Who'd have guessed?
I mean, yeah, you are right. You don't want to see Peter Serretta go to the bathroom. And also, this is another example of a setup from first season of something that we thought would never come back. You know, this character, like, do you guys think that like we'd ever see him again?
Not until I saw the toys showing that he was coming back.
I missed that.
And the trailer, he was in the trailer and I was like, oh, I guess Horatio Sands is back, which is fine. He's funny. I think his timing in this is really interesting. And I think they gave him one of the nerdiest jokes, which works.
I feel like we'll get to that later, but I feel like I don't love the comic relief characters that they're introducing in the series. Primarily the Amy's character from the first season. Well, actually, Amy and the Mithral. Although I liked IG-11, who was kind of comedic in ways, right?
I don't know. I like this because I feel like if anything, you know, with the exception of characters like, you know, a Jar Jar Binks or things like that, like, Star Wars has always had mostly serious characters who are clearly either heroes or villains, you know. And so I think having characters like this, they flesh out like just the the different personalities there are in the universe. I mean, in a place like this, like, you're going to have people who are like weasels, who are scared of stuff and don't really want to get into danger and are worried more about their land speed than they are about, you know, helping out the people that he works for and that kind of thing. And so I think having these kinds of people, especially when you're dealing in a place that has so much, you know, organized crime and things like that, it helps flesh out the character roster a little bit.
You know, when you explain it that way, Brad, it sounds good. I think maybe for me it's the execution of it. I don't know. But okay, we'll get into that later. Mithral, is that what we're going to call him, Mithral?
Yeah.
I guess. Okay.
I mean, that's what everybody else does.
Yeah.
I really don't want to see him evacuate his thorax.
Well, he had been doing accounting for Grief Karga for many years, and he made a run for it after stealing a bunch of credits, it's insinuated. And now he was captured by Mando and returned to him, and now he's doing a lot to work off his debt. A lot of years. Many years of debt. And so repairs are going to take a while, it is explained to Mando. Which, by the way, should we talk about that? Like, it's told to him that repairs are going to take a while. Like, the Razor Crest is in, like, really crappy condition. We have seen it. Like, it's falling apart. It's being held by netting that has been installed by Mon Calamari's. And he's told that the repairs are going to take a while. They go off on this mission, and, you know, by the end of this episode, he's like, the ship's fine, and he leaves on his way. Is that okay?
I think there's two things. One, I think this is the inverse of the gag in season one where the Jawas strip it in about 40 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is Pablo Hidalgo sort of had this saying that he said that you can't actually work out how hyperspace and subspace works in Star Wars because it works at the speed of the story. So you can go as fast or as slow as you need to in order to accommodate the story. And I'm thinking that they were looking at the repairs in the same way, right? Like, maybe that Mimbanese mechanic and that human mechanic just called in like 40 people to come in and get it done as fast as possible so they could just get a quick lunch break. And there you go.
Yeah. And I want to say, like, I know people listening to this probably think I'm so hypercritical of the show. Like, this isn't something that bothers me, but I thought it was worth bringing up.
No, I felt the same thing. That's why I put that in my review, because it was like I could see people going like, especially after they called out that it would take a while.
Yeah. Okay, so they need Mando's help to take out an old Imperial base that is working on a skeleton crew. It's on part of this planet, and this is actually the base was the source of all those troopers that we saw at the end of season one. If they can take out this base, Navarro could finally be free and possibly become a trade sector. So that sounds very important to me. The plan is to take out the reactor, because that's what you always do in Star Wars. And the Mithral is unwilling to drive out to this base. He really doesn't want to. Grief keeps luring him in, like offering years off his debt. And Mando see something above and jetpacks up, and stormtrooper falls to his death. They enter the base. I'm going kind of fast forward through this. I guess the takeaway here is it doesn't look like it has a skeleton crew that they were led to believe. It was that Grief convincing Mando that it had a skeleton crew, or did Grief not know that
when they
there
discover
was more
it's a
troopers
lab
than
his shock is genuine that there's more to it there than that, because when he explained the mission, he also seemed very convinced that it was basically they needed to destroy it, because otherwise the smugglers and the black marketeers would just pick it clean and then have a great field day with all of the stuff they could sell on the black market. And he wanted to cut that out as the magistrate of the system.
So the Mithral spots a mint Trexler Marauder, which could fetch a lot on the black market if the base wasn't going to get vaporized in the next few minutes. What is this?
So this is an Imperial troop transport, which was the first toy that Kenner produced that wasn't in one of the movies. And they're incredibly rare. And I... had the
chance. Well, they used to be.
Yeah, well, they used to be. They manufactured them again for Rebels because Rebels sort of brought them back. I really feel like I feel like I missed out on an opportunity. I had a chance to get one in its original box at like this estate sale, but I had to choose between that or a Death Star playset. And
Death Star.
Went with the Death Star, but now I'm like, you know, that transport's looking pretty good these days.
They also brought it back as part of the vintage collection recently from The Mandalorian.
Yeah, yeah. So it's getting a lot of play, even though it sort of started as a joke. But those original mint Imperial troop transports, they do go for a pretty penny.
And so him making that joke is a joke about the aftermarket of Star Wars collectibles?
I think so. That's how I took it.
For sure.
Yeah. I like that. Okay, so Cara Dune takes out an Imperial officer, and they make their way to the heat shaft to find the reactor core. The Mithral is complaining the whole time, which I guess you guys find funny. I find a little bit annoying. So, like, this whole scene, like, kind of seems reminiscent to me of A New Hope.
Yeah.
With like, the... Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the design of the thing that he has to go climb out over on, like, it's just standard Imperial, like, terrible user interface, right? Where it's just like, we're going to put you in mortal danger in order to do this really harmful thing to our base. So, you know, we'll put the controls there to prevent sabotage. I'm not sure. But yeah, it's exactly like A New Hope. And the Mando actually comes back to this spot later. And has the stormtroopers sort of separating him from the over the chasm the same way Luke and Leia did, but instead of throwing the rope, he jumps away on his jetpack.
Oh yeah, for sure. Okay, so the Mithral sets it to blow. They make a run for it. They discover a tank with some kind of weird body in it. And they realize that this actually isn't a military base, but it is a laboratory. They hook into a holographic transmission that was sent from Dr. Pershing. This is the doctor from season one, who is working for the Werner Herzog character. He is reporting on promising effects for an entire fortnight before the body rejected the blood, leading to catastrophic. Yeah, sorry. A failure. Quote, I highly doubt we'll find a donor with a higher M count. So he's talking about midichlorians here?
I don't think there's any other way to say to read that.
So they're looking for midichlorians. I think this is interesting because this clarifies a little bit of the end game of Moff Gideon, right? So there had been some theories that the child might be a clone of Yoda or something because, you know, that Dr. Pershing had like the symbol on his costume about like a cloning symbol. But this seems like to indicate the clone, the end game of them getting the child is to use his blood to harness the midichlorians.
Yeah. And then inject them into whatever it was in that tube. And then, I mean, I think one of the downsides of this episode is that they're not necessarily clear about what they're hinting at because there's so many different things in Star Wars they could be. Like, is Moff Gideon trying to create a super soldier program? Is Moff Gideon working on the Snoke program? Is this some extension of Palpatine recreating his bodies that produced his kid that produced Rey program?
We'll talk about all that at the end of the episode.
Yeah, well, so it's like there's just so many different things that we can assume about this as a possibility that there's just it raises more questions than it answers.
I just think it's interesting that they don't want the child for the child. Do you know what I mean? Like, they don't like see him as like an asset in terms of like maybe we could use him against the New Republic or whatever. Like, it seems clearly it's just like the midichlorians in his blood.
Well, I mean, he is still a baby, and so like I feel like they'd be waiting a long time for him to mature enough to the point where they could actually use him, like, and convert him to being, you know, an asset of the Empire. So that's probably just their best bet at this point.
Well, they could have cloned him, because didn't the clones like have a rapid aging or something?
They did, but so at least, I don't know. There's a whole lot of stories about what happens when you clone Jedi and midichlorians, and Timothy Zahn in his Heir to the Empire books, the entire premise was that Joris Sibioth, which is Tim's pronunciation, I would never have any idea how to pronounce it any other way, but I've asked Tim and that's how he pronounces it. Joris Sibioth was a mad, like a clone that was driven mad of a Jedi, and he had originally wanted it to be a mad clone of Obi-Wan, and George Lucas nixed that. And then when they were working on Attack of the Clones, you know, somebody said, well, why don't you just clone Jedi? Like, why wouldn't you just want Jedi? And, you know, Lucas's cryptic answer, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, was just sort of like, well, it doesn't work like that. So maybe they wouldn't be doing that for whatever reasons George Lucas has built around the mythology of cloning and why that might be a bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So Dr. Pershing recommends that they stop all experimentation because the volunteer will die if they proceed with the transfusion. I might be reading too much into the wording here, but he does say volunteer like there's a particular volunteer and not like volunteers will die. Like, is there someone special that they might be like intending this for?
That's what I want to know. That's part of all the information that adds up to, like, they could be talking about anybody. Like, what if the volunteer is one of those other Palpatine clones? What if the volunteer is, well, it's not Gideon, but what if it's someone in Gideon's purview, someone he has there on the ship? What if it's one of those soldiers that he has? What if it's, you know, Tom from accounting?
Brad, what do you think here? Do you think I'm reading too much into him saying there's a volunteer and not volunteers?
I don't know. That was one thing that was definitely very mysterious, and I'm left being just as curious about that, you know, too, because it's not clear. And so I really don't know.
I think they're leaving that to be mysterious. Okay, so they were only able to harvest a small amount of blood from the child, and they would need a bigger sample to continue. We also learned that the transmission is to Moff Gideon, and it's days old, so our heroes are now learning for the first time that Moff Gideon survives. So, I don't know. You, in your piece, Brian, for SlashFilm.com, you theorized that maybe that Dave Filoni could be maybe doing what he did with rehabilitating the image of the prequels in the Clone Wars with maybe like the least like thing about Rise of Skywalker.
I think that could definitely be an unintended side effect. I think Dave Filoni, I don't know if Dave Filoni likes Rise of Skywalker or not. It wouldn't surprise me one way or the other, but I know he really loves the prequels. But one thing about Dave and the way I think his mind works is that with all that training from George Lucas, he's able to like connect dots with things in really interesting ways and add context to stories after the fact that really makes them sing in ways that we hadn't noticed or cared about before. And so if this really is leading to Snoke and Palpatine and those plans for Rise of Skywalker out in the periphery of the galaxy, I think that it could have that effect if that's really what the goal is here.
I will say this. I think it doesn't really matter what Dave Filoni thinks of Rise of Skywalker, because what matters with Dave Filoni for me is that he loves Star Wars. And I think trying to elevate weak points in the saga is only beneficial for Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So, Mando jetpacks back to the child because he's worried about him. Greef, Dune, and Mithral try to escape the base before it blows up.
That
There's a lot of action.
That was
here.
A great moment from A New Hope that harkens back to Luke going back to try to save his aunt and uncle too, which actually made me worry for the child for a minute there. Like, if Gideon's alive and he knows, then okay, I'll go get the child, right? Like, it had that, like, if they trace the robots here, they may have learned who they sold them to, and that would lead them back home. Like, it had that same energy to it, and I really liked that.
Yeah. So Cara Dune gets in the Trexler Marauder, and they use it to escape. There's this awesome, like, speed bike chase sequence, which I think is, like, one of the best shot, like, action sequences, you know, with Greef manning the turret guns and the approaching speeder bikes, and they're, you know, they surround the vehicle, they crush them into the rock wall, kind of, you know, I don't want to keep on referencing indie, but it's kind of indie like, and, you know, the Last Trooper begins the empower grenade, which ends up being his own undoing. What did you guys think of this whole, like, speeder bike chase thing?
No, it was fun. It was, you know, it's cool to see this vehicle used in this way. You know, I love little details like this too, because, like, it's cool seeing the targeting system that we've seen so many times in X-Wings and TIE Fighters and the Millennium Falcon. You know, it's the same technology that's, you know, spread across. And so the system inside the ship that he uses from the gunner station is very similar, where you have to center the ship in the middle before you can get, you know, the shot right on the money to take out the TIE Fighters and whatnot. So it was also kind of amusing seeing it used on people when he completely blows apart that scout trooper. And like, you know, like you said, it has a very Indiana Jones feel to it, especially since it's, you know, set in the middle of these big cavernous areas.
It's got this, I mean, it definitely, again, goes back to A New Hope too, right? Like the escape from the Death Star with the four TIE fighters. It's one thing when it's the Millennium Falcon and you believe the Millennium Falcon can deal with those, but when it's this little troop transport, you're like, they're screwed. And so it was really interesting when you shrink the escape craft of the heroes, how those same four TIE fighters can appear a lot more menacing.
Can I take the second to sidetrack us for, like, a quick moment? Because I love speeder bikes. I love the scout troopers. And I want Hasbro to create a life-size replica of a Black Series helmet of the Scout Trooper helmet. And, like, yesterday I learned last night that Target's coming out with this helmet for Captain Cardinal. Is that the right name of the character? He's from, like, Black Spire and Phasma. Yeah. I think he's only appeared in the books, right?
Yeah, he's only appeared. He appeared in Phasma and Black Spire, the novel, and yeah. Well, I think part of the reason they keep doing that is that they can just keep repainting the same First Order molts that they already have red.
But they've never released the First Order helmet, so it goes to your point that this is probably a predecessor of them. They're probably going to release a white version of it as a Stormtrooper.
Yeah, release that helmet, didn't they?
I thought they did.
No, there was one by Anovos, but I don't think they ever released a original trilogy Stormtrooper helmet, but not a First Order. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure for The Force Awakens, they released Kylo and Poe, which are now sold out and now sell for way more on the aftermarket.
Yeah, you're right. They never made a Black Series Stormtrooper helmet. That's very surprising.
Yeah. I don't know. It just surprises me. Like, you know, it's cool that a character from the books is getting this treatment, but I kind of want, like, I don't know. I kind of smell what's going to happen here, and I smell that, like, you know, in a few months, I'm going to see this on the clearance end cap of like in my Target, you know, selling for half the price because no kids knew who Captain Cardinal was. And it's like, Hasbro, make me a scout trooper helmet. Like, they're now in Mando. They're, like, playing a big part in Mando season one and Mando two. Make me a scout trooper.
And it's funny too, like, scout troopers are so recognizable that, like, I have no idea how to quantify, like, how much Star Wars knowledge my 5-year-old has. She doesn't pay that close attention to it, as far as I can tell, but we were watching this episode this morning and she looked at me as though this would be the most revelatory, like, new information I've ever had. And she goes, "You know what those are called? Those are scout troopers." And for them to have imprinted on.
They're so
yeah,
cool.
They are. So, and I really loved the moment where they're skiing down. It felt like a James Bond movie. Like, it was so cool. It was very cool.
Yeah. So I hope one day, I don't know. I want Star Wars stuff to sell. And I just see like this being another, like, you know, Cara Dune, Peg Warren. Like, I think that like Hasbro ends up taking the bad like lessons. They're like, oh, Star Wars toys aren't selling as much as they used to when, like, you know, the movies were coming out. It's like, no, you created a helmet for a character that no one knows about. I mean, well, I don't know. I don't want to sound like super rude because I know there's fans of those novels, but like, you got to admit that a lot less people read the novels than watch the movies or play the video games
Though if there's a chance that maybe this was something that was actually intended to be a park exclusive, you know, because it does have the Galaxy's Edge sticker on it, and I wonder if they're just doing what they can to sell it, since, you know, one of the two Galaxy's Edge locations isn't open. So maybe this is their way to like maybe make some money off of what they have that they're not going to sell at the parks anytime soon.
I definitely got that impression that like they were making money hand over fist selling that kind of stuff in the parks. And now that even the one that is open is at such a diminished capacity that Target doing Galaxy's Edge exclusives was, you know, the licensees needing to still sell that stuff through.
I'll say this, that I'm even annoyed. I'm taking us on an even further sidetrack. I'm sorry, guys. But I'm even annoyed by Hasbro and the products that they've created for Galaxy's Edge, because they created a, you know, an exclusive Captain Cardinal figure, which I get it. It's a repaint. But and then the other figure that they created there's two other figures. They created a Hondo, which eventually got sold in Target, and they created a Rex. And then they also created a Mountain Trooper. So there's this Captain Cardinal figure and there's a Mountain Trooper being sold in Galaxy's Edge that no one has ever seen before in Galaxy's Edge. Yet they don't make a Vi Marotti figure. They don't make a Doc Ondar figure. They don't make a Captain or Lieutenant Beck figure. I don't know. I'm just
saying. My hope is that we will see that stuff.
Don't forget that there's also a Commander Pyre figure, which is another Stormtrooper repaint, the gold one. That also has the Disney, the Galaxy's Edge sticker slapped on it.
Okay. I'm sorry, guys. I know it took us way off track here. We'll get back to the episode. So the TIE fighters are in pursuit. Greef does his best to take them out as Dune takes evasive maneuvering. And Greef finally takes one of them out and crashes it almost right on top of the ship. The Razor Crest comes to the rescue, takes the other TIEs out. Mando has a child who is now still eating his macarons, and he's giggling as Mando is taking them out.
And also sticking his hands up like he's on a roller coaster.
I feel like every episode, like, they're just printing money to make new Funko Pops, right?
That and also infinite memes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then there's also, we need the Funko Pop where the child has barfed on himself.
Yeah, just covered in blue vomit.
He does get it all over his robe. Mando wipes it off, but it doesn't seem to come out. He's going to need a wash or something. Is this any indication that the child's going to get a new outfit, which is going to lead to more toy sales?
We'll see him get in a bath as well. And so then they'll make him Baby Yoda in a bathtub.
What were you going to say, Brian?
No, I was going to say, like, we'll also get an action figure with the stain on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Okay, so Mando takes off. His ship has apparently been fixed in that amount of time. They, like, left. They left for, like, half a day.
Right? Repairs at the speed of the story, man.
Yeah. Paul's son, Hung Lee, is back as Captain Carson Teva. One of the dickhead New Republic X-Wing space cops that we saw previously.
Yeah, if there was any doubt that they weren't just space cops, he's walking around with a little pad of paper and
referred to as officer.
Officer, yeah.
He's asking about the Razor Crest's involvement in the happenings, and Greef denies that it was there and sends him on his way. what role do we think the New Republic will have in upcoming episodes?
You know, I was this was really interesting to me because this kind of further cemented the fact that maybe the New Republic is kind of not doing a great job with what they're doing as far as like helping some of these places that need it. And maybe it's just because there's this transfer of power between, you know, the Empire and the Rebel Alliance, you know, taking over and with the New Republic and them trying to clean up the mess of the Empire, which, you know, has very strong echoes of the things that are happening right now. But yeah, I think it's interesting to note that, like, what Greef does with Nevarro is, you know, he builds this, you know, they have this school and they, like, you know, boost up the economy and things like that, making things better. And there's clearly this parallel of, like, these places that were left behind after they were, you know, taken over and the Empire was there, and they need infrastructure. You know, you need to have those things built. And it's things that, you know, America has infamously not done when they've taken out a dictator like Saddam Hussein or something like that and say they're going to help, you know, a certain nation, but then don't stick around long enough to build infrastructure and help them, you know, get to a place where they need to be to help their people. And so there's a comment that Greef makes here where takes a jab saying, you know, maybe, you know, you'll find yourself out here, you know, again, because they don't ever come out that way unless something like this happens. And so I thought that was a really interesting jab, you know, kind of at the New Republic.
I got the impression, too, though, like I got two distinct impressions from different sort of genres of film and history. But I think part, like, to your point, Palpatine did have that sort of Nero decree with Operation Cinder, where he was literally just burning down as much as he could at the point where he was presumed dead. So that, yeah, exactly. The New Republic would have to put out so many fires that they could never be as successful as they would have been had there been a peaceful transfer of power, which is startlingly relevant. But also, I really love how we're seeing marshals, like with those specific titles in these frontier towns, because it really feels like the Old West, right? When the strong centralized American government was, you know, completely on the East Coast, you know, we call things the Wild West, and, you know, for a reason, because it was just, it was absurd out there. And there was a different sort of law and a different sort of, jurisdiction for what the government was. And I really like that they're taking those cues for the New Republic from that era of history and of film for the New Republic in these far-flung areas.
I also like what this is kind of like saying about the larger galaxy. Like, we always assume as kids when we watch Return of the Jedi and they win the you know, the Battle of Yavin, am I mixed up? Wait, what was the Battle of Return of the Jedi?
Endor.
I've gotten no sleep, guys. Sorry. Battle of Endor. Yeah, I knew when that came out of my mouth, I was like, uh-oh. When the Battle of Endor happened, that, like, you know, everything is going to be happy in this galaxy. And obviously we've seen that that's not the case because there's still remnants of the Empire that need to be defeated. But also, like, you know, we learned from, you know, the ancillary material of Force Awakens that, you know, General Leia, like, knew about the First Order, thought that they, like, you know, were gonna this big threat. And, like, the New Republic was, like, not willing to take action. And she had to create this whole, you know, resistance to, you know, to do something about it. So it's like, it's funny because you always think that there's a good guy that, like, if they won, everything would be peaceful and perfect. But it turns out everybody, you know, every political organization has its own problems, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we see Cara Dune feeding the creature, and the space cop tries to recruit her. He believes there aren't isolated incidents here and something more is going on. She's not interested in helping him or telling him. And he asks about her Alderaan heritage because he served there, and says, did you lose anybody?
What sort of rube does this? Like, hey, I know your planet's destroyed, but did you lose anyone? Like, yeah. I know.
It's like if told me, he was like, I worked at the World Trade Center, but I didn't go there on 9/11. And then my next question is like, Brian, did you lose any friends or coworkers? Yeah. Like who asked that question?
Yeah. No, Captain Carson Tava. Well, and maybe that's just the tone deaf nature of the police caricature they've become.
I guess now that like we're delving in, like it is a kind of like good moment here, but like I still don't want to care about her. I don't know why. Like, do you guys care?
I mean, I'm having a hard time separating the character from Gina Carano at this point, and so I'm caring less and less because every time I see her, I just think, ugh, this is what we have to deal with. But I don't know. It's like she is a cool character, but she's mostly just cool, and this helps a little bit. What is the thing that he leaves behind? Is that like, it looks like a badge? It has the Rebel Alliance symbol on it. What does it symbolize?
So I did some research on it, and there wasn't anything. The Alliance's Medal of Bravery was the one that we've seen in A New Hope, so we recognize that. The best thing I could come up with is a real-world analog is sort of a service medal that says that he served at Alderaan. And so this was one of those things that I was complaining about a little bit about Weathers's direction, is that there's a few things that could have hit a lot harder, but they were a little muddy. And knowing what that medal meant could have been one. And I really think it was his service medal for having served at Alderaan that he gives to her as at least a sign of acknowledgement or respect, or that he just asked a really insensitive question.
I mean, I guess that kind of makes sense, but I feel like that's like also the equivalent of like, you know, a military soldier giving like their Purple Heart to somebody that they just happened to learn, you know, had a relative who died in World War II, you know?
Well, like, I think...
Like that means a lot to that person. And so why would you give it to a complete stranger just because you asked an insensitive question, you know, about...
Well, I wonder if it's an insensitive... Well, I wonder if his thing was just like... It wasn't that he asked an insensitive question. It was that he feels sorry for her loss. And obviously she's not having a good time. And maybe he's trying to pull her... make her feel like she's welcome in a way that her attitude...
Is there any
the
chance
problem,
that
it, I wish this was better.
Is there any chance that it's just a badge that's representative of like we are the New Republic and like they've adopted the Rebel Alliance symbol, and so like
had,
just in case you want to be a space cop like us.
It had a little it had on the bottom of it the same way you see on like the sorts of badges that honor service in like military dress uniforms, like the little color coding at the bottom.
Okay.
That's what it made me think of that service record. The problem is that we can debate about all day about what we think it is, because it wasn't clear.
Yeah.
I'll say this. My first thought here was, knowing Jon Favreau, and he wrote this episode, that I'm not sure if you know this, if you work with Jon Favreau or you visit a set of his movie or you interview him, he gets like these challenge coins. He's obsessed with challenge coins, and he gives them out to anybody that either works for him or, you know, interviews him or whatever. And he makes a new challenge coin for each production that he's working on. And it's something that's meaningful to him. If you talk to him, he has like a whole story on it. And I was wondering if maybe if something like that, because challenge coins,
they're huge.
Come from like the military,
and they're huge in the 501st too, like, and the Rebel Legion, the fan costuming organizations, and they're a huge part of the culture of Star Wars fandom, and in the military. So yeah, it could be as simple as that. Like, he's handing her the, hey, remember I served at Alderaan challenge coin.
Yeah. And it should be said, like, people are probably wondering, like, why is that important or something? But, like, you only get a certain amount of challenge coins when you're, like, you know, in a fire department, or you're in this, like, you know, squad of troopers or whatever. And giving one out, like, is a kind of meaningful thing. That said, I'm not sure that that's what it is. I was also wondering, maybe this is an actual badge that makes her a real marshal on Navarro? Do you know what I mean? It gives her some kind of real authority.
There's too many damn possibilities that are all valid.
Yeah, plus I think she also does, she has some kind of like indicator that she's a Marshall already from Grief, doesn't she?
Yeah, possibly. I didn't even see that. Okay, so an alien informs the Imperial General that a device has been planted as requested, and she says that he will be well rewarded in this new era. This isn't an alien we've seen.
Well, we saw this earlier in the episode. He's one of the two people that Grief told to take care of the ship.
And
I didn't even notice that.
And okay. This species is from Mimban, which we saw first on screen in Solo, A Star Wars Story. And recently in Star Wars Squadrons, the leader of the squadron of rebel pilots is a Mimbanese pilot.
I found it interesting too, because Grief has a line when he tells the mechanics to take care of the ship that is, it's not quite like verbatim, but it's reminiscent of Lando's line telling Han, is like, my people will, you know, take care of it, essentially. And then it's not Grief that has, you know, betrayed his friends this time. It's one of his mechanics who has put a tracking device on his ship.
Yeah, we don't think Grief is involved. Well, no, there's no way. It wouldn't make any sense at this point. Okay, so she informs Gideon that a tracking beacon has been installed on the Razor Crest. Gideon is still invested in the asset. He says they, quote, will be ready. We pull out to reveal an army of these big black, I guess, stormtrooper-like things. They look bigger than...
They look like beefy... They look like beefy, like, crosses between Death Troopers and TIE Fighter pilots.
I felt in this moment that it was, like, some kind of, like, thing that I should know. Like, that I wasn't getting the reference, but I'm, after reading online, it doesn't seem like anybody clearly knows what the, like, this is just a, like, oh, no, there's a big, he has a big army of something.
Yeah, no, that was... was like, well, he's surely either that, or he just really likes shiny TIE pilot armor to be displayed properly on his Star Destroyer. But again, this is one of those little details where it's a little muddy, so it doesn't have that impact. If they would have shown us, and again, I'm not saying that he should have spoon fed us, but just given us some view of what we might be looking at, or some context of what that might be. And
yeah,
I
was waiting for like a full, like, head on shot of like, just so you could clearly see what it is after you see the long line of them. But then it didn't happen.
There are some websites out there that are saying that these are dark troopers.
Yeah. I was actually just going to say, I wonder if this is the Lucasfilm's opportunity to bring in dark troopers from the expanded universe.
Yeah, they were in the video game Star Wars Dark Forces.
They have an action figure.
Which is now
action figure.
They did? Yeah. Okay. They're now considered non-canon. However, they did appear in the mobile game Star Wars Commander, which is for some reasons canon, so maybe they're canon again. I don't know. According to Wikipedia, Dark Troopers are a kind of advanced shock trooper droid that the droids were designed under Emperor Palpatine to be the next generation of stormtroopers. The Republic, however, sabotaged manufacturing facilities, forcing Palpatine to shut down production do you think these are, I mean, that might make sense, because it makes sense why all these like armor are like there. If they're droids, it makes sense why they're like all like being charged or in.
But
wonder.
I also got.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, no, no.
Okay. I also kind of got the distinct impression that this was something that was also tied directly to the lab, right? This was something that was tied directly to what it was they were hiding and why he wanted the asset so badly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. And I think that's like, this is maybe like a new breed of super soldier. And I wonder if maybe they're trying to create a force sensitive army.
Yeah. One of my friends messaged me with that. And I did not get that from this. Am I wrong, Brian, in saying that George Lucas originally had an idea of like stormtroopers that had like force powers, or am I just thinking of Ralph McQuarrie's concept painting with that they had a lightsaber?
I think that's probably what it is, those early paintings. But I mean, those early drafts of Star Wars were all over the place too. But I wouldn't, if they were going back to the well of Ralph McQuarrie on this. I think those troopers would have been white, though.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to have to find out. I did see, I think on Inverse, someone pointed out that the lab technician in the scene is wearing a coat with the insignia for the Imperial Department of Military Research, which was first mentioned in the 1989 Star Wars role-playing game. So there you go. Okay, let's get into do you have any final thoughts on this episode?
I think it's adding up a lot of threads. Like, I really, really think, although we're getting more of a movie of the week style for this season, I really think it's threading a lot of really interesting ideas together so that we're going to get a really impactful last half of the season. This is our halfway point. And it's built a lot. It's built a really solid foundation of how things can go wrong or intersect or come together and crash into opposition. And I think that this season has done that a lot better than last season did.
Okay, let's get into speculation. We're going to see Ahsoka next episode, right? It's written by Dave Filoni. I think it's directed by Dave Filoni. Like, we're going to get her finally, right?
I think so. I really don't think Dave Filoni would have stepped in. And this is what we said last week too. We're like, I think we can all pat ourselves on the back for that, right? We were never going to see Ahsoka introduced in the Carl Weathers episode. It was going to be Dave Filoni. And if she's around, it's going to be next week. Or, and I could be wrong here, but just in case it turns out to be real, I could be really seem really smart. Ahsoka's not on the show. And they cast her and let those things leak the same way they did Mother with Alfred Hitchcock. And we're all thinking we're going to see Mother as this villain or Ahsoka here as this thing. But Ahsoka's gone. She's on her mission and it was a dead end. And he's going to be trapped there with Moff Gideon on his tail.
I don't think you're right on this one, Brian. But
I don't think I am either, but it's a possibility.
But it is interesting. This does bring something new to the dynamic. We knew that he was going to go to that planet to find Ahsoka. But now, after this episode, we know that unknowingly Mando is bringing the Imperials right to her. Right? Like, he now has a tracking beacon. Not only are they after the child, but maybe now that they see him meet up with Ahsoka, maybe she's going to become another...
Imperial target. She's got a lot of midichlorians in her blood.
My guess is the meeting that they have, the first meeting here, is going to be short-lived. There's going to be some stormtroopers that show up, maybe those dark troopers or whatever. Brad, what do you think is going to happen?
We talked about last week, about how Ahsoka, probably has some insight or would have some concern about any cloning technology being brought back from the prequel era. And so, I feel like that will definitely have, some weight on her shoulders, and whether or not, like, if she's just chilling somewhere, I guess it depends on what Ahsoka is up to when Mando finds her, and whether or not, there's this, rejection of coming back, and being caught up in all of this again or whatnot. But I think it's interesting because if you go back and watch all of the trailers, we haven't seen any more footage from the episodes coming the rest of this season. We have exhausted all the footage that was shown.
Oh, yeah, really?
All the footage that was ever shown in trailers has been played in these first four episodes. So from here on out, we're completely in the dark with as far as anything to expect.
Okay, I only have one last question that comes from this episode is, why didn't, if they were able to get that close to the child in this episode, why didn't they just take the child on Nevarro?
I don't think they realized, like, what happened is probably they said, hey, look out for this ship, and if you see it, install a tracking device and let us know. I don't think that they knew that the child was there until he reported to them, right? Because she asks at the end, like, was the asset with him? And that's when the Mimbanese mechanic confirms that, right? So, like, they don't even realize the child is there until after the child is gone.
Yeah. Is there any other speculation of what could be coming for us in next episode or the second half of the season? Well,
I think as they're tying those threads together, I actually think that Captain Carson Teva is going to play a bigger role in this. If the Imperials show up at Corvus and Ahsoka's there, she's probably got some connection to people in the New Republic. And, you know, as he's talking about, hey, something big is brewing out here and people don't necessarily know it. We might not get it this episode, but I do think this season is going to result in a space battle. I think it's going to end up in a space battle where the New Republic and what's left of the Imperial forces and the Razor Crest and Ahsoka and whatever she's flying, whether it's in the Razor Crest or whatever, are going to end up in a big conflict in space. Because I think that they're threading all of those things together.
I mean, I think that sounds right. So I think you might have that dead on. Okay. That brings us to the end of today's Slash Film Daily. You can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. I'll link Brian's review of this episode in the show notes if you want to see that or you want to read that. This podcast is published on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. If you want to send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, if you have any insight, speculation that we did not touch upon, you can send that to peter@slashfilm.com. You know, tell us who was the second unit director of this episode. Yeah. if you want.
They turn out to be a listener.
Yeah. Please rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you on Monday.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.